Rensselaer to the world. This is RSVP, Rensselaer's award-winning distributed education program.
Looks strange. Okay, welcome back. This is the penultimate lecture. Today we are pleased to have a guest lecturer, James Manchester, who's now at RPI. And I think the best way to, there are two ways to introduce him. Okay, he held several positions in Bell Laboratories, the research and development side, all the way to senior positions, as well as he spent time as a senior, as a vice president of product development at Telium. So we have in flesh and blood somebody who's actually worked on optical networks. Another way to introduce him is to take a look at the textbook. So can we point here, please? Yeah, this is a textbook. Okay, if you go to page 782, there are references to James Manchester's papers. Okay, so he was one of the pioneers in sonnet and survivability, some things we've learned in class. So without further ado, James.
Thanks. All right, so Shiv asked me to come in and give a presentation on some trends in terms of broadband networks. So I thought that I'd break the talk into two different segments. The first segment is just kind of a review of some terminology and things that you might have already been exposed to. And we'll step through that pretty quickly. And I hope that everybody feels free to be very interactive and ask lots of questions. And then what I wanted to do is expose you via almost like an economic analysis to expose you to how decisions are made with respect to deploying broadband technology. And to do that, I put together an analysis that we had done in the industry with respect to IP over OTN. And it's a pretty detailed analysis, you know. We may not get through it all, but it's there so that you have an opportunity to see how the decisions are made, what kind of factors come into play when decisions are being made from an economic perspective, when a service provider goes to deploy new technology. And that'll lead us right into sort of ongoing investigations in IP over OTN networks. Just to tell you a little bit more about myself, I graduated from here in 1995 with my bachelor's degree. I went to Bellcor, Bell Communications Research, then went to Bell Labs, where I was the youngest research and development director in Bell Laboratories. And from there, I went to an optical networking company called Telium, where I took over all the business aspects of the company, and that was my last position as a vice president of product management before I decided to, I guess you could say, in a sense, retire and come back to school. It was a tough decision. It was between this and potentially going to Florida and waiting in the early bird buffet lines with people that were not in my generation. So I decided to come back to here. But I thought I'd give you, you know, let's be interactive. Ask me lots of questions. I don't want this just to be a one-way conversation. Of course, I can do that, but I'd prefer not to. I thought I would start out. I told you a couple of the companies that I worked with, and I thought I would give you just a brief historical aside. I definitely was what you would call a bellhead. And in the context of being a bellhead, what does that really mean? Well, I told you that I worked at Bellcor up there, and it was the research and development arm of all the regional Bell operating companies. Prior to 1984, that was all AT&T. That was all part of AT&T. So as you see on the slide here, after 1984, Bell Labs got broken in half. AT&T took one portion, an equipment manufacturer, which later became Lucent. And the regional Bell operating companies, the U.S. West, which is now Quest, the Bell Atlantics, which is now Verizon, those companies took Bellcor as their research and development arm. So I worked at Bellcor, and eventually Bellcor got spun out from the RBox into Telcordia. And so I had I left Telcordia, but before Bellcor spun out Telcordia, they spun out a company called Telium. Okay, so the Telium down there. So I went to Bell Labs and then to Telium. So it's all part of a chain of routes here with respect to of the Bell system. So you kind of see here the Bell system legacy today. These are all the companies that are out there that exist that trace their roots to a common structure, which was AT&T Bell Labs at one point. And just by the mere, you know, I guess you could say being in the right place at the right time, I was actually involved in two IPOs associated with this chart. The first one being Lucent. I was involved in Lucent's IPO when they spun off from AT&T, because when I originally joined Lucent, it was AT&T. And then also with Telium. I was able to be part of Telium's initial public offering, and those were quite exciting times. Anyway, let's start with a review of transmission. And I put in parentheses transport. I put it in parentheses so you wouldn't get confused with the transport that's associated with IP. A lot of transmission people are called transport people, but it has nothing to do with transport associated with IP, so I put that in parentheses. So we'll cover some of the technologies, architecture, and evolution. And I have some questions here. I don't know, maybe you get some bonus points if you can answer them. I don't. Here's the first opening trivia question associated with this. Does anybody know what the difference between a DS3 is and a T3? Or a T1 and a DS1? Anyone? Yeah.
DS3 is just a multiplexing level, and T3 is the typical specification that actually transmits that DS3 from a multiplexing level from the receiver to the sender.
This is you're correct. A DS3 signal is just the inter-office or inter-equipment signal itself. The T3 signal is the T in front of that means the basically the portion that can go outside the central office or can connect an inter-office connection. So you're absolutely correct. So that's the difference. An interesting thing you see happen a lot in industry is people refer to these things, as the same thing, and I will probably do that as well through the lecture. But a DS1 and a T1 are essentially the same thing. One is just what can go outside the building, and one is what typically stays within the building. So I'll refer to both of them. But that was the first trivia question. Now, prior to the development of SONET, you had what was called the asynchronous digital hierarchy, which developed, and basically, you had DS0s. The DS0 is just a phone connection. It's a plain old telephone service, the 64 kilobit per second service. And, rather than take, phone connections and interconnect everybody's houses, right, via DS0s, what they do is they multiplex these up and, they switch them around in the phone network. So as you can see here, DS0s get multiplexed into a DS1. You get 24 DS0s into a DS1. You have 28 DS1s into a DS3. And then before SONET came about and before newer technologies came about, there were proprietary systems that would transport these over fiber and multiplex them in. Probably the most common of these was called the 565 systems, which was developed by Philips and eventually acquired by AT&T. But this was the asynchronous hierarchy that took place. And what you typically had happen is this was not considered probably around 1988. Okay, this was starting to cause lots of problems in the telephone networks, because at that time you had all these connections that need to be groomed, multiplexed, and switched around. And for the most part, all of this was done via manual operations. And the equipment to do this was extremely expensive. And yet, you still had a tremendous amount of growth happening in the network. And so, what you see here is basically an architecture. This DSX3 actually corresponds to a patch panel. The M13 is just a DS1 to DS3 multiplexer. You have a DSX1 patch panel. So, in other words, these patch panels are things that an operator, a craftsperson in a central office, actually has to go in and configure themselves. And people started to automate some of these, but there was definite issues associated with scalability because of the asynchronous hierarchy, which we'll discuss in a minute. But what you're going to find out in terms of telephony networks is that even though, and in fact later on we're going to talk about a first cost analysis, the most significant expense associated with telephone networks, or any networks for that matter, is the operations. And it's probably the most difficult to quantify, and it's probably the least discussed out there. So some more review questions, right? What does the acronym SONET mean? Anybody know what the acronym means? Yeah, go ahead. That's absolutely correct. So I'm going to tell you guys something that's quite interesting. Sonnet, actually, the name was coined by a person who was a Belcour fellow named Yao Chao Ching. He was the guy that actually brokered a compromise between the United States and the ITU in terms of the international and domestic North American standard for this. But Sonnet is neither synchronous, neither optical, and it's not a network, okay? So this was the most bizarre name that you could give this particular technology. And in fact, Sonnet is actually asynchronous. Sonnet is actually, it's an interface specification, so it's not a network. And it's not optical. It's actually an extension of the digital hierarchy. So that leads us to the acronym SDH. Everybody knows what SDH means? Right, synchronous digital hierarchy. That's actually the correct terminology, and that's what was used by ETSI, and that's what's used by ITU and the international standards. That's actually a much better description of what this technology actually is. Does anybody know what fundamentally differentiates Sonnet or SDH from the asynchronous digital hierarchy? Anyone? Well, up until this time, I referred to the equipment being expensive and this being cumbersome to move these signals around in a network. One of the fundamental things that takes place when you're doing multiplexing of two signals from two different timing domains is that you have to account for the differences in the timing domains. Okay, so you're bringing in a DS1 from one domain, a DS1 from another domain. You're going to multiplex them together. You have to account for the fact that they're coming from two different timing domains. And the way that that was done in DS1 was that was done via a mechanism called byte stuffing. So in any event, you would bring in two signals and you would rectify the difference between their timing by stuffing in bytes to try and bring them together and align them. And this meant that if, let's say, you brought a DS3 into a central office, and for the most part, all the traffic in that DS3 was going to go out the central office, but you just needed one DS1. What you had to do is you had to demultiplex that entire DS3 down to the constituent DS1s and actually drop it off. You couldn't just grab a DS1 right out of the DS3. That made the equipment quite cumbersome. It also introduced scalability problems associated with the equipment. Okay, this byte stuffing, trying to do it at high speeds at the time, was seen as a very expensive and very cumbersome mechanism to account for these timing domains. So there was actually an interesting character that the person worked at Nortel. His name is John Elson. I had the privilege of working with him at Bell Labs. But he somehow or another, he was a programmer. And somehow or another, he got involved. He was actually doing software systems for Nortel Lightwave stuff. And he got by some quirk of fate, ended up at a standards meeting one time. And so they were trying to figure out how to develop Sonnet, how to scale the asynchronous digital hierarchy. And this question of timing domain differences came into play. And, of course, here's a programmer. And so what did he do? He said, guys, you have this overhead. Why not just start mapping the stuff in and let the frame slip and put a pointer in there? And that concept, that pointer processor, that pointer concept, is the fundamental breakthrough with Sonnet that enabled it to scale beyond, 45 megabits per second and actually become the technology of choice for transmission networks. So that was kind of interesting. It's interesting because you get, a different perspective from somebody comes into a room with a bunch of engineers that have worked on the same problem for 20 years, and all of a sudden, boom, you have a very elegant solution. So that was quite an exciting time. When they came out with Sonnet and SDH, in terms of the standardization of this, they were looking for this broad set of sort of Nirvana principles, right? Vendor independence and interoperability, elimination of all the manual operations, so no guys running around hooking up patch panels and things like this, a reduction in the cost of operations. Protection was a major factor they wanted to try and implement. The asynchronous networks really added survivability on as an afterthought. They didn't have it incorporated at the very beginning. And they wanted faster, more reliable, less expensive service to the customer. All these things sound great. And to be honest with you, in retrospect, when you look back on it now, I think they did a pretty darn good job. Sonnet is very much a ubiquitous technology today. You can take you can go buy chips right off the shelf from one vendor, and you can interconnect them to another vendor, and it's a multi-billion-dollar industry even today. So in retrospect, they did a really nice job at this. But we're going to find out later on that the one thing that they didn't think of, and the one thing that they didn't really accommodate, although they did a little bit, was the sort of advent of broadband networking in the context of broadband data signals, right? So, you know, every aspect of Sonnet was actually developed associated with the transport of voice signals, right? And so here you actually see one possible particular mapping into Sonnet of a DS0. DS0 gets multiplexed into a DS1, it gets multiplexed into a DS3, and then for transmission, it gets multiplexed into a synchronous transport signal, level 1, which is 51 megabits per second, to be transported across the Sonnet network. Okay, there's also an alternative way of mapping DS0s, which you probably haven't covered. But that is basically, there's a thing called a container called a VT1.5, where you can put a DS0 right in. So if you have an office and you don't want to multiplex into DS3, you can take DS1s directly across. And what makes this technology quite interesting, when you compare it to the asynchronous technology, is that you can take a DS0 if you were doing it in the VT1.5 mapping, or you can take a DS3, for instance, in this particular mapping, and if, let's say you have an OC48 coming into an office, and you have an OC48 going out of an office, and you just need one DS3 out of there, you can pick it right out. You don't have to demultiplex the whole thing. You have pointer processors in there, which point to the particular payload area. You just grab it, pull it right out. You can add another signal right back in there. It's a very nice, elegant operation. This is just an interesting thing that developed in the context of international standardization. The North American people wanted a base level signal of 51.84 megabits per second, and the European and the rest of the world wanted a base level signal of 155 megabits per second. These kind of things you can never explain with respect to, you know, any kind of rational reality. This was basically a lot of politics at play and things like that, which typically takes place in standards. But what's interesting now is that there actually is an STM0 level in the ITU, so they at least had enough foresight to name it STM1 so that you could go back one and have an STM0, which was 51 megabits per second. It's not used as commonly in Europe, but it is used in the Far East quite a bit. Anyway, so Sonnet was great. Sonnet developed this sort of network layering that we all talk about when you're doing IP and ATM and all these great technologies. You have all these network layers. Well, they apply the same concept to Sonnet to try and minimize the operations expenses. And so what you had was you had the definition of these three overhead sections in Sonnet. You had the section, the line, the path. The section and line are called the transport overhead, the path overhead. And basically what happens is between sections, the section overhead can get terminated and reinserted. It's used for the management of sections. And I'll give you an example of how this works in just a second here. But here you see a Sonnet point-to-point network, a basic point-to-point network. You have a terminal multiplexer on one side, another terminal multiplexer on the other side. In between, you have a couple of repeaters, right? Well, those repeaters define what's called a section in Sonnet. It's actually called the regenerator section in SDH. Let's take, for instance, you have this repeater. It's somewhere out, who knows where, let's say in Kansas somewhere, and it's buried in a hole in the ground. You know, if you have a problem with that, you don't want to necessarily send a crew out there, right? You're out in the NOC and you get an alarm. You want to be able to troubleshoot that from the NOC location. And so that's what the section overhead's there for. You can actually send a signal out. You can get performance information on that section. You can get all kinds of OAM stuff. You can make connections. You can do traces to that section to try and troubleshoot and isolate it before you actually have to send a crew out. The same thing goes with the line. A line is actually defined between multiplex sections, and in fact that's what it's called in SDH since they use the better terminology. But between multiplex sections in a network, you can do the same thing. And in fact, they have, you know, all kinds of great features, things like what they call order wire, where you can walk up, you can actually plug a phone into a craft terminal. So if you're out there working on it and you're in this remote location, you can actually plug a phone in and the phone signal goes across the Sonnet overhead back to the NOC and you can talk to them and troubleshoot the problem. So from an operations perspective, it was very, very well conceived. It was very well thought out. From a survivability perspective as well, there was a tremendous amount of foresight that was applied in adding the survivability characteristics to the networks. I'm not going to go into detail into these architectures, but I just want to talk about them for a second. The first architecture that was developed was just a point-to-point protection architecture. One signal, another dedicated signal, point-to-point in parallel selection at the tail end. The next major breakthrough was the unidirectional pass switch ring. This was actually developed by Bellcore, and it's a very simple operation. All the working signal travels around one direction of the ring. All the protection traffic travels around the other direction of the ring. The traffic is bridged at the head end and is selected at the source. The better the two is compared based on their performance criteria or based on the reception of a loss of signal or an AIS, and you just select. It's very fast, less than 50 milliseconds typically. And these things have been deployed all over the place, and I'll show you where they get deployed in just a second. Next, you had the development. This actually came out of Nortel's BNR group, which was the equivalent of Bell Labs for Nortel. I'm just going to apologize for the slides. I had cut and pasted a bunch of slides, so this, I don't know what these squiggly characters are. So in case you thought I was doing some kind of complex mathematical operation. But basically, the fundamental breakthrough with the BLSR was this. The BLSR took half of the capacity on an individual fiber and dedicated it to working, half of it dedicated to protection. And so you could have bidirectional connections that took place. So you didn't have to wrap, one this way, one this way. You could actually have the bidirectional connection take place across the ring, via the direct spans. So the working and the protection traffic would travel along the same span segments. And this was developed by Nortel and actually pushed through. This is actually standardized in T1, ITU, everywhere, and it's a very common type of architecture out there, and I'll show you where as well. There's also a four-fiber variant of this, and so you can think of where I have half of working and half protection on one fiber. There's actually two fibers now. One is working, one's protection, but the path still traverses, the working and protection still traverse the same spans. So, looking at those ring networks, and I already gave the answer away, which Sonnet ring network is simpler? Obviously, the unidirectional pass switch ring. And I don't know whether any of you guys could take a look at this so far, or if you've studied it already, and you can tell me which Sonnet ring network is inefficient for distributed demand sets. In other words, when you have this ring going here, and you have, let's say you have an equal amount of demands between all the nodes. Anyone? Yeah, it's not intuitively obvious unless you get down and understand the technology, but the bidirectional lines or the unidirectional pass switch ring is very inefficient when it comes to a large number of bidirectional demands. Okay, so when there's a tremendous amount of distribution with respect to the demand around the ring, the unidirectional pass switch ring starts to fall apart. By fall apart, we mean it starts to exhaust its capacity. So you start to take a look at it. You can actually draw it out, a very simple ring. You could use DS3s and have an OC3 ring, and you'll see very quickly that if you have distributed demand sets, that you run out of capacity very quick. It's not the case with the BLSR because you have that ability to connect pass directly with both the working and protection. So what did that mean? That meant in terms of the evolution of the architecture, and this is actually, this is fairly typical, this architecture right here is fairly typical of every regional Bell operating company telephone network that's out there today. You have these access rings that are in a small area. So let's say there might be an access ring or a couple of access rings in the Albany-Troy area, for instance. And you have those being dropped off to digital loop carrier terminals, for instance. Okay. Now, all those digital loop carrier terminals are homing back into a master phone switch called a 5ESS, or I can't even remember what other people call it, but it's commonly referred to as a 5ESS. It's a thing that's processing your calls when you're making calls into the network. And so what's happening is you have a whole bunch of demands, right, on the access portion of the network, which are hubbing into one or two big switches. And so for that application, the unidirectional pass switch ring works fine. You know, the demands are all to one point in the network, so it doesn't exhaust as quickly. And You know, and the UPSR is very simple to operate, very simple to set up, very simple to understand. So for the most part, those have been deployed in access rings, you know, throughout the country. You'll find them everywhere you go. Next, you had this situation of, okay, so I'm making a phone call, and I need to connect from city A to city B. So I create this sort of regional or intra-regional ring, right? And let's just say, for instance, there's a UPSR ring in Troy, and there's a UPSR ring in Albany, and I want to make a phone call from Albany to Troy. I've got a 5E in Troy that's processing one end of the call. I've got another 5E down in Albany that's processing another end of the call. That needs to go across an interregional ring. And in the interregional case, the demands are much more distributed. And therefore, if you put a UPSR there, it would exhaust very quickly, and you'd end up with lots of stacked rings and lots of operation problems and lots of heartache. So what happens is you have this interregional ring, which is BLSR based, which connects up interregions, and then typically you may have a large, like OC192, regional bidirectional line switch ring to interconnect lots of different areas. And here's another interesting tidbit for you guys. What happens is you get all these connections into an office, and you still need to move around DS0s, right? The mechanism for moving around DS0s is called a wideband DAX, okay? Now, DAX is a term, Digital Automated Cross-Connect System. It's also referred to as DCS, Digital Cross-Connect System. It's also referred to as DXC, Digital Cross-Connect System. Depends on who you're talking to, what vendor, whatever, but they're all variants of DAX, okay? And DAX are defined, not to add any more confusion to the terminology that gets, you know, thrown out there with respect to networking. DAX are defined with respect to the lowest order grooming capability that they have. So a wideband DAX does DS1 grooming. A broadband DAX does DS3 grooming. So it could have any number of interfaces, OC3, OC12, OC48, but if it grooms at the fundamental level of DS3, it's a broadband DAX. If it grooms at the fundamental of level of DS1, it's a wideband DAX. If it goes higher than DS3 or STS1, it's typically considered a optical cross-connect. These are just terminology that's just put on there. Go ahead. No, you're actually... Okay, so when I say groom, that's a very good question. When I say groom, I mean you can go from any port to any other port. So you demultiplex and you switch, okay? So that's what I mean by grooming. An element that does just multiplexing, demultiplexing, is either an add-drop multiplexer or a terminal multiplexer. So as you can see in this network, the access rings, you know, get cross-connect capability via wideband DACs because they have DS1s coming into them. DS1s are switched off to the regional rings. The interregional ring, typically you have a broadband DAX in a large office that's doing the grooming or the switching of DS3s for you. So this is great. You have these wonderful rings. They're highly survivable, 50 milliseconds. Life is good. You pick up the phone. You can call grandma anytime you want to. It's fantastic. You get a perfect connection, all that other good stuff. Let's talk about how DWDM came about into the phone network. And so everybody knows what DWDM stands for, right? I mean, I probably shouldn't have put that up there. It's probably a pretty stupid question, right? Dense Wavelength Division Multiplexing, right? This is a good one, though. Does anybody know the fundamental technology that enabled DWDM network deployments? This is a fundamental breakthrough. It's not fiber. It's not lasers. These existed for a long time. What is the fundamental breakthrough? Yes, absolutely correct. It is the optical fiber amplifier. Okay, the optical fiber amplifier. What he referred to as an which is the most commonly used optical fiber amplifier, the fiber doped amplifier. Right. So basically, you have a piece of fiber that has that is doped with this E compound. We'll call it, since I can't pronounce it, and you pulse it with light. You excite the element that it's been doped with, and since it's been spliced onto another fiber, it actually adds energy to the incoming signal. It's very much an analog amplification. It does have noise accumulation issues, which hence you don't have DWDM signals that traverse the whole world before you get electrical regeneration. But what's interesting, with the development of this optical fiber amplifier, and what you see here is a bunch of OC48 terminals interconnected to another OC48 terminal, spank of OC48 terminals, What's interesting here is you can, I mean, I don't even have to quantify the cost savings associated with this. You have all these expensive electrical regenerators and fiber pairs that are necessary to do this. They all go away with these, this relatively inexpensive optical fiber amplifier that gets deployed in there. So the benefits are very much there. But the first deployments of DWDM, and what really drove DWDM, was the long distance networks. We didn't really talk about the long distance networks much, but the long distance networks are typically consist of toll switches and these the bidirectional line switch rings, because the long distance networks are very much a distributed demand set. Okay, there's not a hubbed type of demand like there is in the access networks or in the RBOC networks. So they had a lot of BLSRs. So if you take a look at Sprint, if you take a look at MCI, if you take a look at any of these companies that do long distance, including AT&T, although they're kind of an interesting case, these people have built these, you know, DWDM networks. Now, as the traffic started to grow, you know, you had cell phones and all this other stuff, people connecting via the internet, via dial-up services and things like this, you had this interesting problem start to develop with respect to the long distance networks. The long distance networks, these guys had limited amounts of fiber and they had limited rights of way, okay? By rights of way, I mean they might get access to a fiber route from Kansas City to pick a city. I don't care, any city, two different cities. But they have limited access and limited rights of way to that. And so as they started to exhaust the capacity there, they would start to run into problems. How do I get connections between A and B now? And DWDM enabled that. This is actually a situation that we modeled in Sprint's network, where you had a large number of BLSR fiber pairs coming in, and they had limited rights of way, and they were running out of fiber pairs. So the obvious solution was to go in, put in DWDM, and it solved the problem right away. It was absolutely fantastic. But this was still definitely an extension of the telephony networks and telephony architectures. And this, you know, DWDM has been widely deployed in the long distance architectures, in very significant quantities. So, I think it's pretty obvious now, after this discussion that we just had, that the existing transmission networks that have been deployed out there today were designed around voice, right? Every aspect of them has been designed around voice. The DS1 is the fundamental technology that drove the multiplexing rate of the STS1 and Sonnet. Every aspect of it is designed for voice operations. There was an afterthought that took place, which was the development of a concatenated signal format in Sonnet to help accommodate data. But from a networking perspective, there really wasn't a tremendous amount of thought that was put into transporting data across this infrastructure. And as you had this traffic growth take place, around 1995, 96, when the levels started to really increase and IP started to really take off, what became interesting was that, I'll explain it from here. This is actually quite nice. This is indicative of WorldCom's. In fact, I believe this was WorldCom's architecture at one point. And all you're seeing here is the service provider's data architecture, their data architecture. So you see they have a number of different data services, right? Data service, they have public-private internet peering, right? This is a service that they had. They had these remote access farms, RAS farms. Okay, that's a service. These pink boxes off here to the right, these are actually RAS terminals, dial-in terminals. You had a number of leased line data connections. So you had ATM connections providing leased line connections back into the internet. And this was the basic architecture, but you're seeing it from a data perspective, and you have access routers, ATM switches, core routers. Notice the redundant configuration in all the core routers. That's the best thing that, the product manager that thought up the architecture for redundant configurations for routers for reliability is a genius. He's living somewhere in the Caribbean now on his own island. Because rather than force the router vendors into building reliable routers, they basically convinced everybody that two is better than one and you don't need to build reliability into it. But that's changing now. But what I want you to see is that All this architecture, all these black lines that are in here, and especially in the center and off to the left here, these are all big pipes. These are all OC3s, OC12s, and OC48s coming off of these switches. And think about it for a second. If you're dealing with ATM or you're dealing with IP, your multiplexing and your switching and grooming level is the ATM or IP level. That's what you're moving around. So if you want a connection to go from A to B, you're going to switch that packet around. You're not going to switch an individual DS1 or a DS3. And if you had to build that into router ports, right? Router ports are expensive enough when you have to do all these lookups and all this other crazy stuff. Now you're going to have to multiplex, demultiplex DS1s and things like that. People said, no, let's just give us a big fat pipe. Give us a big pipe. We'll interconnect it. We'll do all the grooming, the multiplexing at ATM, the IP level. So all of these black lines imply a transmission infrastructure is necessary underneath of this to provide those connections. And what people actually found out was that the existing SONET SDH networks that were deployed out there for the voice networks, right, which we think is great because they're optical networks and all this other stuff, became a bottleneck to transporting broadband connections. It became a bottleneck. This is very easy to see. If you have time, take a look at an OC3 ring, okay? An OC3 ring will have typically DS1 accessed on the drop side, and it'll have an OC3 and an OC3 UPSR. It'll have an OC3 east port and an OC3 west port. Now try and add a broadband connection to that. Maybe you can get a DS3. You will see that this ring just exhausts just right away. It just goes, exhausts very rapidly. Very inefficient for transporting data. And so what ended up happening is, remember I was talking about the long distance providers? Well, just by sure chance, the companies like MCI WorldCom and Sprint and this sort of thing, they were also in the data networking business, in addition to long distance. So they had all these, they had this whole long distance business, but they also had all these data services, and they were already deploying WDM terminals to fight off fiber exhaust on many of their key routes. So what did they do? They started looking at this new architecture of mapping IP ports, especially OC48 and above, which are difficult to network in the SONET domain, directly into the optical network, or directly into the DWDM network, I should say. And so you had this situation developing in the late 1990s, and it's still taking place today, where you have core IP routers or core ATM switches being sent. The connections that are broadband get sent across the DWDM network. Okay, so it's been adapted for that DWDM network. And just as in SONET, the first equipment that came out in SONET was multiplexers and add-drop multiplexers, and eventually cross-connects came about. The same thing is happening in the optical domain today. You had the DWDM terminals, then you had limited add-drop capabilities, and now you actually have optical cross-connects. Okay, so that has been driving the architecture towards what is called an IP, if you look in the standards and things like that, they call an IP-OTN architecture. IP over optical transport networking architecture. And this takes us to the present day situation. You have these people that have deployed DWDM out there. They're deploying optical switches to manage those wavelengths, to switch and groom those wavelengths. And now you have core data traffic that's got to be going into there. The architecture is a little deceiving because where you see these MCs, that stands for multi-channel interface. That actually implies a DWDM interconnection between the two. And so now you have this architecture which is being examined and investigated, and it has all kinds of interesting issues and problems. This green domain, this optical cross-connect domain, has its own topology, right? It has its own topology. This IP domain, which is the outlying nodes, has its own topology. So what, how do you combine the two topologies? That's probably one of the biggest issues that drove the whole GMPLS interworking that's been taking place in the IETF, and in fact it's bled into the ITU as well. So I'm gonna move into the economic analysis now. To give you a feel of that, but I wanted to motivate you to the point where we are today. So I kind of took you through the whole evolution of the transport architecture, how it got to where it was, and now where are we today? We're kind of at this picture today. In fact, we're kind of at a picture between broadband connections across WDM and broadband connections across this optical networking infrastructure. Okay, and of course the key question today is, does this actually make sense from a service provider's economic perspective? Does it make sense to transport IP across these broadband connections across an optical switch architecture? Okay? Versus transporting them across DWDM directly and just having IP do everything, okay? So, you know, there's two schools of thought here. I'm going to present you with an economic analysis that was done. I worked on this with my friends, Dabanjan Saha and Subir Biswas, both of which were at Telium with me. Dabanjan's now at IBM and Subir's now a professor at Michigan State. You have to understand that we were doing this analysis because we were working at Telium, which made optical switches, okay, and we were trying to sell optical switches. So I want you to keep that in mind, okay? And, of course, I want you to keep another thing in mind. These economic analyses that are done, you can tweak any particular parameter, and you can come up with a different result. So you can change parameters to match what you want to get accomplished. This happens all the time. It's widely accepted, and basically you figure out how to prove in the way you want to prove it in, and you hope that you can convince the customer to believe that, agree with it, champion it, take it to their internal people, and also do the same thing. So there are 100, you know, we created a model to do this whole thing. There are 100 different things you could take apart in this whole model. Just remember that we were actually trying to sell something when we put the thing together. But I wanted to expose you to it because it's probably one of the few things that you won't get exposed to, unless maybe you're going for an MBA or something, that you won't get exposed to in just in regular technology courses here at RPI. So this is basically how we go. So there's two camps out there, right? One camp believes that I can just keep building bigger routers, and I should deploy those routers over DWDM just directly and let IP take care of everything. And then you have another camp that believes that you could take IP and that you should actually combine IP with the optical transport network, okay, and that you should marry the two up together, and that will result in a better operations infrastructure, that will result in better reliability for the network, that will actually be cheaper, okay? So we'll get into the discussion of that. Here are the two architectures, and you'll see that this looks very similar to the last architecture that I showed you from a data networking perspective. All the routers are deployed in what we call the quadrangle architecture. They have dual homing. They're cross-connected to each other for reliability. They're going directly across DWDM, and then you have the other architecture, which says, listen, push the routers off to the side, put an optical switch in there, and let's switch in the optical network, and let IP do its thing out on the edge, okay? And we'll analyze this particular situation. So you have architecture A, IP over DWDM, and you have architecture B, IP over optical networking, right? Just discussing the quadrangle redundant configuration of the IP routers, I mentioned this before, it's being done to improve reliability. I don't need to get into too much of this, but basically you have two basically head-end routers which are providing the connections into the DWDM domain. You have two low-end routers which are providing all the client connections into that, and they're interconnected in this quadrangle configuration for reliability. The other thing that you'll notice about this particular architecture is that when you look at POP1, let's say you had a connection that needed to go from POP1 to POP4, right? Let's say you had, let's just say it was an OC48 worth of traffic that needed to go from POP1 to POP4. You got to go through all these router ports to get to POP4 at POP3. So you actually have to go, you can see how it starts to be a little bit inefficient, and you may actually start to see where the results are coming from. So talk about the pros and cons, IP over DWDM pros and cons. The pros, you have the IP routers with big interfaces today, OC48C and OC192C, and with amazing amounts of throughput. They've actually fixed all the forwarding problems in these things, so they can start to forward at line speed now. They've done a significant amount of work in the IETF to improve the service performance of IP, and using protocols such as MPLS for traffic engineering and things like this. You have the IP routers controlling the end-to-end path selection, You also have sort of this model where you have peer-to-peer router connections being established to exchange the routing information. The con of this particular architecture has been, you know, does the router technology actually scale, and will the IP technology actually deliver on the promises of being able to provide performance, reliability, restoration, speed, and software stability? This is a very key issue in router design. This is software stability, being able to have. I mean, in a router, you're essentially creating a gigantic database, and you need to maintain consistency of that database across the network. So these are big question marks as to whether the IP over DWDM domain will ever be able to do this. In terms of IP over OTN, you have pros and cons as well. Now, obviously, you have to put pros and cons on both sides of the argument when you're going in to do this with a customer, right? Because otherwise, they think you're just trying to, you know, you're just trying to cover your own territory, and that's it. But the pros of IP over OTN, you get a reconfigurable optical backbone, right? So you get an optical backbone where if the demand sets change dramatically from one day to the next, you can reconfigure the optical domain to account for that in a relatively flexible manner. The core optical switch network can be shared amongst other services. So the voice network can use it, the ATM network, the frame relay network, any other network that develops. The cellular traffic can be piped across this thing. Everything can be using this. It also allows the interconnection of IP routers in an arbitrary logical mesh topology. So you can determine what topology you think is optimum for your routing domain, okay? And you can essentially impress that topology onto the optical switch architecture, and it'll give you that topology in the IP domain. The cons, obviously, you're introducing another layer into the network, and that layer comes at a cost. It comes at a cost associated with management. It comes at in operations, and it comes at a cost of additional equipment that needs to be deployed. And you have this con, which we kind of alluded to before, but you have, especially today, right, all this stuff that's being done in standards hasn't been realized today with respect to GMPLS and this sort of unified routing plane and things like this. You still have two separate management systems. The people that developed optical switches developed them for, I hate to say it, but they developed them for the telephone network. So they don't have SNMP interfaces on them, or they're not managed by SNMP systems, right? They're managed by TL1, and they go into existing OSS infrastructures, right, in the telephony network. So you still have two different management domains. You still have two different topology domains. You still have this separation between the two boundaries. The other thing that becomes interesting is this question of glass through, right? So, okay, why do I need to pay a lot of money? And when you see the prices on these things, you're going to go, you know. But why do I have to pay a lot of money to put an optical switch in there when, you know, I could just send a guy out there and just, you know, if I have that 10 gig demand between, you know, POP 1 and POP 4, I'll go down to POP 3 and I'll, you know, plug a piece of glass through there, right? Well, you know, that's not really a viable solution for a couple of reasons. One is it costs a lot of money to send people down there and plug fibers in and route the fibers around, but you also lose a level of reliability in the network because now you've introduced multiple connections that you have to troubleshoot in the event of a failure. It becomes a very, very ugly situation. And you lose all the operations capabilities of the network. Most people don't even spend 2 seconds on this particular slide. Now, in terms of the network deployment cost analysis, you already know what the answer is going to be because I told you what company I worked for when we did this, right? The answer is going to be that you can spend less money by deploying the two network elements, or the two architectures simultaneously together. The other thing is, in the critical observation, and we discussed this, we have some slides to go into this and you can look at it later, but the amount of transit traffic when you're looking in the core of the network is much higher than the amount of add drop traffic. In other words, there's a lot more transit traffic. And in fact, on average, a good rule of thumb if you're just doing some basic network engineering is that in a node, in a core of a network, about 75% of the traffic is going to be pass-through traffic. That's a pretty good rule of thumb to use if you want to design something, and we actually have some charts to show that based on the degree of connectivity and things like that. Hence, the fundamental thing that makes this work is when the router ports are much more expensive than the optical switch ports. Okay, and we'll see that in a second. Okay. I'm wondering how much I really want to go into on this. This is kind of a busy slide. Maybe I'll just highlight a couple of the scenarios. There's two demand models, right? The two demand models are 2.5 gigabits per second between nodes, and the other one is 5 gigabits per second between nodes. That's a fairly conservative. Those are fairly conservative figures for the core of an IP network. The other thing that we assumed is that the average degree of connectivity in the nodes is 2.5. So that's the average number of connections coming into the particular node. Let's see what else is important for you to understand. The quadrangle configuration, which is deployed, was assumed. The light path for the routing domain, especially when we get into restoration analysis, was actually done on a shortest hop routing mechanism. And the IP routers, you would have to. Current IP routers have about 64 ports before you have to upgrade and buy a new chassis and put a new one in. Optical switches have about 512 ports. This is very consistent with what's happening in the industry today, so that's not controversial at all. And we did the models with restoration being done in the IP domain and compared it to restoration being done in the optical domain as well. So we have with and without restoration. Okay, so here's where we get the exciting the price numbers, which are always exciting. IP routers and optical switches have fixed per port costs, right? And we basically used, you know, this is a benchmark, so we basically used list prices for currently shipped products, okay? And for an IP router in the core, you're looking at like a the latest variant of a GSR, the latest Juniper core router, you're looking at a fixed cost up front of about $200K to get started, and you're looking at a per port cost of $100K for an OC48 and $250K for an OC192. So these are very expensive ports, right? These are very expensive. And in fact, you know what I always tell people is if the industry weren't the way it is right now, but if you want to make a lot of money in technology, the best way to make a lot of money is in the sales organization, because to give you an example, at Telium we had over a 3-year period we had $1 billion worth of contracts, and you have these salespeople that are making commissions off of this stuff. These people, our highest paid salespeople, made a lot of money. The Cisco highest paid salespeople make a lot of money. If you really want to make money, you become a salesperson. Don't be an engineer. And then for the optical switch, you had an upfront initial investment of $1 million, and then you had a per port cost of $25K and $100K for OC48 and OC192, respectively. Okay, that's a very good question, actually. Because when you're talking about, and this is actually pretty intuitive, when you're talking about an OC192, what you're talking about is on an optical switch, for instance, you have the OC192 interface coming in, maybe some demultiplexing to OC48, and that being switched through, right? When you talk about an OC192 on a router, you not only have the SONET functionality, but now you have all the router functionality associated with it as well, which is not inexpensive. Typically, these are custom ASICs. A lot of them have a ton of FPGAs on them. And then when you actually formulate the pricing, it becomes very expensive. So, and you basically just hit on the fundamental rationale that we use for this. If you have this transit traffic, do you really want to burn up these really expensive router ports, or do you want to offload it on relatively cheap and inexpensive, in a relative perspective, optical switch ports? So this was without restoration. These are, you know, obviously, we had models that we used to come up with these. And in fact, we actually developed a tool Dabanjan developed a tool where you could input any particular network architecture, input the demand set, whether you wanted restoration or what, and it would calculate the break-even points. But this is just a representative network of 18 nodes, 2.5 degree connectivity, 2.5 gigabits per second uniform traffic, and what it shows is that actually it's not 18 nodes. The crossover point is 18 nodes. It shows this versus the number of nodes, and what you see there is actually millions of dollars. It's actually billions of dollars, right? When you look at 1,000 million, it's actually $1 billion. So what you see is that if you were going to go out there, that you can see what the capital investment is to actually start your own company like this or be a service provider. Let's say you just want to do IP over DWDM for 30 nodes, you're looking at about $1 billion of capital investment to get that network up and running. That doesn't count operations or ongoing expenses either. But what you can see here is that if you decided to go with the IP over OTN, while the bar doesn't look that far away from it, that actually is probably about $100 million worth of savings in your pocket, which, you know, is quite substantial when you're trying to raise funding and things like that. And of course, you could always apply that $100 million to other aspects of your network as well. For 5 gigabits per second of traffic between POP pairs, no restoration. The crossover point is actually at about 15 nodes. You see the same pricing on the side here. And you can see that as the number of nodes increases, that your savings become much more substantial.
So 15 pops.
And then this is just a graph that shows what I was mentioning before. This is the we did this graph because people, we would always say just assume 75%, and people, you would say, I think mine's more like 25%. We said, well, that just doesn't make sense from a networking perspective. But so this just shows the percent of transit traffic without restoration versus the number of nodes in the network, and you can see that as you start to increase, you actually start to get close to 75 to 80% transit traffic in the network. And that's just comparing between degree 2 and degree 3. Obviously, if you increase the connectivity, that's going to go down somewhat. But, you know, degree 2.5 connectivity is pretty common in core networks, which is what we use. So you have 2.5 gigabit per second traffic with restoration. Now here the assumption was you're going to provide some type of redundant pass through the IP domain to provide restoration, or you're going to provide the optical switch architecture is going to provide restoration on its own. Okay, so you're burning up extra ports for restoration in either the IP domain or you're burning up in the optical domain. And since optical ports are cheaper, it's cheaper to provide restoration in the optical domain. In fact, the cost savings become much more, the break-even point becomes much more, much better. The break-even point actually goes to about 8 nodes for 2.5 gig and goes down to 4 nodes, which is a very low break-even point for 5 gigabits per second traffic. So as the traffic increases, that break-even point comes down even further. And this just shows it's the same slide as before in terms of the transit traffic, except now we've added restoration as a metric. So you're adding redundant paths into the network as well. So you're going to have, you know, if you have a working path that transits this way, you have a route-diverse backup path. You now have added additional transit traffic into your network because of that protection path going through. So you have 80 to 95% now. And this is just a summary of the whole thing. Obviously, you know, I just wanted to expose you to the type of economic analysis and things that are done in trying to justify the modern day architectures today. And in fact, this presentation was used as late as 6 months ago in terms of going in and pitching this type of architecture to service providers. So this is up to the date. This is right there in the thick of what's happening in the industry with respect to architecture analysis and economic justification for the deployment of new architectures and new equipment. So I won't get into that because that's more geared for them. And then we would also make the case for restoration of the optical level. Restoration, what you'll find out in the industry, restoration or survivability can become a very controversial topic in when you start talking about IP and you start talking about data networks. There's some controversy because the phone people, remember, they're the bellheads, so to speak, are out there, and they're always thinking about that connection to grandma or that 911 connection. You know, they want when you pick up the phone and you call grandma, you want that connection to go through right away. You want to talk to grandma. You want that connection to be perfect. You know, if a backhoe is somewhere in the middle of the country and takes out a fiber conduit, you know, what does grandma and you have to do with that that mishap, right? Whereas, you know, in the data networking community, it's been, you know, there's been a lot more tolerance for, less reliability in terms of the network, although that's starting to improve. It's actually kind of interesting because the wireless domain has been kind of interesting because the wireless people actually picked up on sort of the data networking people, you know, their ideas. So your cellular connection is typically terrible. I mean, the phone quality is terrible. The connectivity is terrible. Your phone drops all the time, you know, and people put up with it, and they still pay money for it. So the wireless people are kind of like bellheads that have been reformed, I guess. So that's always interesting. But if you want to know where the state of the art is right now with respect to broadband networking as it applies to IP over OTN, this is a very hot topic right now, and this is being investigated in a lot of different places from research universities. It's not being investigated in industry as much right now because of the industry downturn. So, you know, the onus is now upon research universities to investigate and examine these problems with respect to networking. But it's still being investigated in some of the standards bodies like the IETF and the ITU. But these are the major questions. You know, can the IP layer provide reliable service, right? And you could probably write 20 PhD theses on this topic alone. How much restoration is really required for services? You could spend all day talking about that particular thing, right? Examining all the services and trying to determine whether 50 milliseconds is okay, or whether 2 seconds is okay, or whether a restoration time of 10 seconds is ideal, or, you know, you can balance all these metrics, and you could write a lot on that too. And which I have too, so I know. But then you have this issue of interaction of the routing protocols with optical layer restoration. Actually, this is a very interesting topic. You know, you have OSPF and BGP and all these routing protocols running, and they're running across this transmission infrastructure which you've now put in place. When they're running across DWDM, you don't have any problems because DWDM is just dumb pipes, right? So if one of those things goes down, and let's say a timeout goes for the timeout in OSPF goes, the rerouting is going to take place. Everything's going to be stable. Everything's going to be fine. But you can imagine if you implement this optical network and you change the topology suddenly, or there's a failure in this optical network and you try and move the topology around, let's say the IP layer starts to react to it, right? You can start to create these instabilities in the IP network based on the interactions that take place, based on the things that take place in the optical network. And a lot of people are studying this right now. This is really cutting edge, and it's not a simple problem to address. And then obviously GMPLS and all this other stuff, if you're really into routing, this notion of a unified routing plane or the optical routing. If you know the topology of the optical network, if you know the topology of the IP network, how can you combine the two to get the sort of optimal routing in the network? And there are many more topics that are being spawned from where, you know, the network has now evolved to from this perspective. So, all right, that's all I had for this one. I should go ahead.
How far taking off in the metro areas or in the Bell network, in the R-box. You talked about it being taken off
in
the core network.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because from my perspective, from a business perspective, you know, DWDM was definitely there for long distance networks. There's a real economic driver for it, and it has been deployed tremendously in those networks. It has always been sort of on the promised land for metro networks, and most people, when they say metro networks, they're typically, you know, the metro networks that are left are a few of the high powered CLECs and the RBOX, right? And so, but to date, there hasn't been a tremendous amount of DWDM deployment. I think there may have been, like, Bell South may have deployed a couple of DWDM terminals. Verizon may have deployed a couple, but they really haven't deployed that many. But there are a number of interesting companies that are coming out right now, and I can think of one, for instance, which is quite interesting, a company called Movaz, which these people are making what they call these metro optical networking products, which are doing very interesting things, combining very low cost DWDM with some SONET functionality and attempting to put it into the metro architecture. And the argument goes like this, right? When I showed you this architecture before, which was, I don't want to go backwards. Can I go forward? Yeah. Well, I'll just describe it. When you had this architecture before, remember I showed you these rings, this hierarchy of rings? When you run out of capacity on one ring, you know what they do? They deploy another ring right on top of it. And you have these stacked rings. They're not interconnected, but it's this big mess, right? The idea is that you can collapse that hierarchy of rings, that you can stop that, and that you can combine DWDM with SONET functionality to do that. And that's the idea sort of in the metro optical movement right now. So it'll be interesting to see how it pans out. The companies that are attempting to play in that market are still hanging in there, even given the industry downturn, and certainly, you know, we wish them a lot of luck in breaking into those networks. But
do you think the DSL cable modem is going to drive, currently the
cost is
more DSL cable modem deployments? So
I'm not a big fan of DSL. I mean, I have cable modem. I'm not sure that DSL is that strong of a service. I think a substantial amount of those deployments, I don't know how much of those ongoing deployments are going to, you know, kind of drive that forward. But that certainly is, you know, like in the cable markets and things like that, that is certainly a great application for the metro optical networking boxes that are coming out. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, you know, it could be a nice turnaround point. But we're definitely, you know, for a turnaround to occur, we're definitely in dire need of bandwidth consuming applications. So, you know, besides the ones that already exist, you know, Napster and other ones, which I won't mention. But so that's, you know, that's really what's one of the things that's necessary to try and. The other thing that happened was, you know, the networks were growing so fast and the capacities were, you know, doubling and tripling every year, and people can just automatically assume that it would continue to be that way. And so they built out their networks to handle this, and eventually you reach a saturation point, right? Eventually, you know, you have to use all the capacity that you've actually deployed. And, you know, they got to the saturation point where you run out of services and you run out of the need for this capacity, or you run out of this sort of three times or four times demand. Maybe it's only one times or two times. And ended up overbuilding, and we're still in a period where we're trying to catch up to that perspective as well. So, any other questions, guys? Any? Hope it wasn't too boring. Hope it was fun. I talked to Shiv. The economic analysis will be on the final exam, so you'll. No, I'm joking. That's a joke. So.
Yeah, well, you will have all those parts covered for the exam, so make sure you read it. So let's give the James a hand. So don't worry, they're going to have a break for the next class.
And next class, I'll just finish up the remaining slides, and I made a few more slides on optical switches and so on, and that will be the last lecture of this course. I hope to have a few minutes, about 15 minutes, to answer your questions about the exam. Just to remind you, the exam is going to be next week. It's going to be a comprehensive exam, which means that you're not allowed to forget what you learned earlier. Okay, so and it will have a weightage or bias about 40-50% of the exam material will come from what we covered since the last exam, but there will also be a substantial amount of credit towards the earlier part, and remember that the final exam has more weightage towards the full grade. Okay, so please prepare well, and me and my TA will always be available to answer your questions. Okay, we're going to take a 10-minute, 15-minute break right now, and we'll come back at 7:25 as usual. Thank you.